This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the place we meet for good conversation. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, have you heard the phrase, well-behaved women rarely make history? In honor of Women's History Month, we're launching a month-long series on quote-unquote uppity women. But first, sculptor Korzhak Zukoski was well known in the Boston area when Lakota chief Henry Standing Bear asked him to consider carving a mountain to honor a chief. So did his celebrity help or hurt him in the process of carving the memorial to Crazy Horse? Jeff Waring is an assistant professor at Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. He reflected on this and other questions in his presentation, Who is the Reluctant Celebrity? Waring spoke with Lori Walsh of South Dakota Public Radio's In the Moment.
Jeff Waring joins us on the phone now from Spearfish. Jeff, let's start with this word reluctant and give me an idea of how this idea of looking at reluctance in this story first sort of bubbled up for you.
Yeah, so I started looking at, you know, the role of these different men, you know, in this creation of the memorial, right? And so Chief Henry Standing Bear came up with this idea to create a memorial, but needed an expert artist to actually do it, right? The problem is that, you know, here you have this transplant in Korchak who's coming down from Boston, right, not associated with the native people at all, and kind of stuck into this, you know, cultural phenomenon. Hmm. And, you know, for him as a white man to be the figurehead didn't really make sense and kind of brought up a lot of controversy. And so, you know, he had some reluctance there to be the celebrity overseeing the project.
Huh. Tell me about him as an artist before this time. He's from Boston. He's well known. What's he well known for doing?
Well, so, you know, he did a lot of art in the area, so sculptures, so local sculptures within towns. Really, he had just won this big national contest. And so that's mm-hmm. where Chief Henry Standing Bear found out about him. And I'm forgetting the name of the contest offhand, but sure. He had won this national contest, and I think it was at the World's Fair or something. And so he was getting all this press. He had also done some things along with, you know, he had come down to South Dakota and done something with Borglum, you know, who was doing Mount Rushmore. And so he was slightly known in the area, but it was more from the newspaper that Standing Bear knew him.
All right. So who's Chief Henry Standing Bear?
So he was basically a local Indian who, you know, had this idea that he, you know, wanted to honor his people. And he was a relative of Crazy Horse and said, hey, you know, this would be a good way to honor, you know, honor our people as a whole by creating a memorial to Crazy Horse. And it was really actually important that he was a relative of Crazy Horse because in the culture, you know, you couldn't do something like this just, you know, out of the blue. You had to be related somehow. And so that's why that was important of who he was as a relative.
So does it start out as this idea of what you see when you drive to Custer today? And was it supposed to be as big as it currently is?
Well, so that's actually what I think is so interesting. I don't know for sure, but I don't think Standing Bear had that grand of a vision, right? He wasn't comparing it to like Mount Rushmore. He was comparing it to some of the smaller statues and memorials that have been done across the country. And, you know, he just wanted something there. And I think that Korchak is really the one who started having this grander vision, right? So, you know, this vision of having the largest memorial in the world and then actually going beyond that. And I think that's where the story gets really interesting, is Korchak didn't see the memorial as being an end in itself.
He's obviously thinks big, but then he thinks beyond just the mountain itself. Tell me.
Korchak views the mountain as a way to get people to learn about the culture, but also as a way to kind of raise money and support to ultimately put in a museum and a cultural center, which is there now, and then a university, which they've actually created the university. I look at it as the other reluctant celebrity, and ultimately someday a medical training center. And so Korchak had this bigger vision of this whole campus on the site. That's to actually kind of lift up the native people today and in the future. And that went way beyond what Henry Standing Bear originally envisioned.
All right, I missed what you said. There was another reluctant celebrity. Who was that?
Yeah, so I look at the other reluctant celebrity being the university. So,
okay.
The university actually has started on the site, and it's the Indian University in North America. And, it started up. They've been pushing it since 2010. They've had this going on as a summer program. And not many people know about it. So I talk to my students, and they just think about this giant mountain being carved. And they don't realize that, yes, this other part of the vision to create a university has already begun.
Hmm.
And, they've had, 189 students who have gone through the program already. And yet we don't know about it. We don't hear about it.
What kind of university is that? What kind of program are they teaching?
So they have classes. They have algebra, speech, composition. So all of these courses that you would have your first semester in college, they provide them for these largely native students the summer before they would start college. So it's basically getting one semester under their belt before they get started at a traditional college. The advantage is it's very intensive in terms of academic advising and getting them ready, for all their future courses. And so there's a lot of college success prep that goes into it as well.
And this is this is Korchak's idea?
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing. So,
yeah.
and people don't know about it. And
no.
So I look at this as like it's this hidden gem. And so, he talked about it in the press. The earliest instance I found was 1957 when he mentioned it in the press. But there's actually a letter that Korchak wrote to Standing Bear back in 1950 where he mentions it. And so it's like it blew my mind. Here I was thinking, this is a great idea for this university center, but, it must be a new idea. And then I keep going back further and further through the records, and I'm finding these references to it. So obviously Korchak had this bubbling up from the beginning, and it's just finally coming to fruition, 50, 60 years later.
And is it physically located by the memorial?
It is, yes.
It is.
It's located
right there.
At the memorial. They received some donations to build an actual building with dormitories and then the classrooms.
So what's his sort of relationship with education, higher education, that becomes, a person who's not from here, who doesn't have a lot of Native American connections, and he comes up with that?
Yeah, well, he was, Korchak was a big proponent of education and on continual learning and reading. And, they're at the memorial site. There is an awesome library down in the basement, for use by the students. And they have, the family has a personal library. And, just really there's this whole mentality of education being incredibly important that has been fostered through Korchak and his family. And so this is just part of it, of sharing that with the Native people.
And are you finding in your research any thoughts back from Chief Henry Standing Bear or others that supported Korchak's early ideas about a university at the site?
That's interesting. I haven't seen anything from other people talking about it. It's mainly just quotes from Korchak. It seems to me that, Standing Bear was very much focused on just, let's build this memorial and, maybe talk to tourists and share the culture a bit. But this grander vision this was Korchak's vision.
Hmm. How does he sort of change as a person then, as a man, from an artist from Boston to who he becomes later in his life? Talk about his path a little bit.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of him, like before and after pictures. It is an incredible physical change, right? So he starts out as this, skinny little, almost upper class looking guy, right? Where you'd expect him to be going to fancy parties and all that.
Right.
And over time becomes this mountain man. And, so this physical change, I think, is representative of what happened to him personally. He became very focused on, this was his life. He went from doing all these little projects to, one project that was going to consume the rest of his life.
Really?
It's funny, as I read, I read a lot of letters that he wrote, and, man, it's I wish I could have met him. Yeah. Actually, I wish I could have met him back in the 40s and then met him again, you know, later on in his life, just to be able to experience that change.
So tell me about his letters some then. What kind of writer is he?
Insanely blunt.
Really?
yeah, no, he did not pull back. And actually, a lot of the letters that I read are written by his wives. So his first wife, Dorothy, or his later wife, Ruth. They wrote a lot of the letters, and I think it's because when Korchak wrote to people, I mean, he didn't hold back. It was just, this is what it is, you know, let's move. I mean, yeah. Very much focused on being productive, getting the work done, you know, none of this being political and being nice and flowy. He just wanted to get right to the point.
And what did he want to get done? The sculpture itself? Is that what he's really is occupying his time?
Yeah, I think that actually did occupy most of his time during his life, was getting that done. He dealt with, it's amazing how much politics he had to deal with. And I could tell that he hated dealing with it, but he had to deal with, you know, things going on with the state and didn't like that. So he wanted to focus on the art.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is Dr. Jeff Waring. He's from Black Hills State University. Jeff, I'm wondering about this medical center then. Is that something that's in development still? I haven't heard of that either.
Yeah, so they have not made progress that I've seen announced, at least, regarding the medical center. It's really, the statement is, it's when it's practical. So, you know, it's still there in the plans, you know, long term. And if you look at on site, they have a big, you know, diorama of what the site will hopefully eventually look like. And it's in the plans, but it's when practical. And so they're being very deliberate with what steps to take so that they can offer, you know, really good services. And so that's not actually, I guess, the university medical training center is not moving forward. It's the university and the pre-college class.
Now, did you grow up around here? Are you from South Dakota?
I'm not. I'm from Pennsylvania.
All right. So you came west as well. Do you kind of feel how do you sort of look at this memorial as, you know, its a role in tourism in the state, its role in business, its role in art and culture? What are your thoughts when you first saw that mountain for the first time?
Well, so, you know, I was initially interested in it just because I love big things, right? So I love these projects that just seem so unbelievable, and this idea of, like, you know, what can we do as human beings? And, you know, that's what initially drew me to it. I think it has a huge draw for tourists. I think it brings a lot of people back to the state because they come and they see Mount Rushmore. They get home and then somebody says, well, did you see Crazy Horse while you were out there? And so I think it gets a lot of repeat tourists for the state, which is great. In terms of art, I actually know very little about art. I think it does the whole site. The museum is wonderful, and the cultural center for helping people to understand the culture of the native people. And you know, it's funny. I don't send as many people there as I would like because. Everyone's like, oh, can I do it in 2 hours? And I'm like, no. Like,
no.
if you only have 2 hours, you go see Mount Rushmore. If you're going to go in and, you know, visit the Crazy Horse site, you really need a half a day, I mean, just to be able to see it. And so I think that's the thing. There's so much there. And, I mean, man, I've made 20 trips there before I saw everything.
That was Jeff Waring, assistant professor at Black Hills State University, visiting with Lori Walsh of South Dakota Public Radio. Coming up next, Drive Through Ash Wednesday.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Insurance, helping to preserve peace of mind and independence with home, auto, life, and long-term care insurance solutions. Learn more at Bremer.com. Bremer Insurance, for what's ahead.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Ash Wednesday marks the first day of Lent in Western Christian traditions. Its name comes from the practice of blessing ashes made from palm branches from the previous year's Palm Sunday and placing them on the heads of participants. Many churches have services today, but some church leaders also take to the streets to bless the busy. Joe Larson of St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Fargo is one such pastor. I spoke with him in downtown Fargo.
We're offering ashes for people out here in the streets. They can drive up in their cars or just walk by, and we do a quick prayer and imposition of ashes on their forehead.
And am I correct in thinking, though, that normally on Ash Wednesday you would go and visit a church and it would be, generally speaking, a longer time commitment, a little bit of more time for prayer and reflection versus drive-through?
Yes. Normally there's a service that you do. We're doing a service tonight at Churches United with the homeless, and so it'll be about an hour long with prayers and hymns and things.
So why are you doing this version?
Well, it's a way of bringing the gospel out to the people in the street. You know, some people who maybe have been alienated from the church. St. Mark's is very welcoming towards LGBT people. I happen to be a gay pastor. So we realize some people have been hurt by the church in the past. And so this is a way of bringing God's love to them where they are.
How long have you been a pastor?
9 months.
Oh, okay. So you're pretty new.
Yes, this is my first call. I went to seminary a long time ago and decided not to get ordained because I was gay, because back then you couldn't. And in 2009, the ELCA changed their policy. And I had been involved in the social service sector my entire career. And so I felt the call back to ministry. And St. Mark's called me as their pastor, which is very exciting. It's still pretty rare for congregations to do that. And so I moved from Minneapolis here to Fargo.
What did the calling feel like for you?
The call is something that started when I was a kid. I had people in my home congregation in the town I grew up who said, you should be a pastor. And that's what I had always intended to do. And when I was young, I didn't realize I was gay. And didn't start coming to terms with that until I was in seminary. But that was at a time when I couldn't share it with other people, so it was a secret. And so it was very painful, very hard, because I had gotten a lot of support from people in my home congregation, and it was very hard to make that decision. And now that I'm doing it, now that I'm doing things like offering sacraments and preaching and leading worship service, it's something I know that I've always wanted to do. I just feel such a joy in the opportunity to do it, even though it's kind of a late second career kind of thing to do for me. I'm still glad that I can do it now.
Well, there's no small amount of crossover between social work and the church work, wouldn't you say?
Right. Yes. And I was very involved in HIV/AIDS. I was executive director of the Aliveness Project in Minneapolis, which is a community agency that serves about 1,700 people per year living with HIV and AIDS. So I was there for 14 years. So that was certainly a form of ministry.
What was the reconciliation process like for you, being gay and wanting to serve, and traditionally speaking, the religious community not always open towards the gay community?
Well, I think a lot of LGBT people tell you that it's a painful, long process, and it's difficult to find a congregation that really, truly welcomes you. They may say, oh yeah, you're welcome here. But when it comes down to real issues like, can I get married to the person I love? Or am I treated like everybody else? Or is the church okay with doing things with LGBT people? So it's a process where you go up through ups and downs. And it's not always easy, because I know there are people who don't accept me as a gay pastor. But I've been very open since I've come here, and I see that as a form of ministry, that I'm paving the path for people like me in the future. Because right now I'm the only openly gay pastor in all of North Dakota. So it's a little lonely at times, but it's wonderful. The congregation I work with, St. Mark's Lutheran in Fargo, is just a wonderful congregation. They live out the gospel.
What do you mean by that? What does that mean to you?
Well, it's more than just saying that we love people, but they actually do it. And doing things like working with homeless people, advocating for refugees, taking a stand on LGBT rights and things like that. So it's a real world kind of gospel from my perspective.
I know you said you've only been a pastor 9 months, but you have been religious your whole life. Can you just reflect on your time in the church, in the demographics that you have seen come and go around between here and Minneapolis?
Comparing...
just what you've seen in your lifestyle. Have you seen, like, as every generation sort of has its own kind of take on religion a little bit, and maybe there's more of these sort of religion to go. We still want the religion, but we don't necessarily want the church part of it, the actual sitting.
Yeah. Well, I think we all know that younger people aren't going to church like they used to back when I was growing up. And a lot of them have been alienated by, well, things like the gay issue, where they think that the church should be welcoming towards all people. And when they see that not happening, they feel like they don't want to belong to an organization like that. And there are a lot of people who have decided that church isn't important to them. But doing things like what we're doing today is a way to reach out to them and say, there are still people who care. And there are places that you can feel welcome, like St. Mark's.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Joe Larson of St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Fargo. Coming up next, Natural, North Dakota.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, Fargo Theater Executive Director Emily Beck is here to preview the upcoming Fargo Film Festival and will show film clips from all the winning films at this year's festival. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Chuck Lura teaches biology, the study of living things. But that doesn't mean he's not interested in the rest of our natural world. In this week's Natural North Dakota, he teaches us about Pier Shale.
I have a couple of fist-sized rocks in my office. They're a deep, muddy brown to gray color, and upon closer observation, it becomes clear that they are loaded with small clamshells about the size of your little fingernail. These rocks are pieces of Pier Shale, and were collected many years ago along the Missouri River in South Dakota. Shale is a sedimentary rock composed of clay, silt, or mud. It forms on the bottom of calm or very slow-moving bodies of water. Over geological time, the sediments become compacted, forming a sedimentary rock. Shales are known for containing fossils of aquatic or marine species. The mosasaur on display at the Heritage Center of Bismarck, for example, was extracted from Pier Shale. Pier Shale, as you might presume, is named after Pier, or perhaps Fort Pier, in South Dakota. It's marine in origin from around 75 million years ago, when much of the Great Plains was a shallow inland sea called the Western Interior Seaway. Pier Shale and other types of shale underlies most, if not all, of North Dakota. The shale's close to the surface in the eastern part of the state, and generally dips and thickens westward. The shale's exposed in Cavalier and Pembina counties on some road cuts in river valleys, such as the Park and the Pembina Rivers. It's also exposed in the Cheyenne River Valley and perhaps in some other areas in the eastern part of the state. But outcrops of Pier Shale are most often associated with the breaks along the Missouri River, particularly near the North Dakota-South Dakota state line when the water levels are low. In my experiences, it's even more prominent in Lake Oahe in South Dakota. Whether you're in a boat or on the land along the Missouri River near the North-South Dakota state line, you may see a layer of dark-colored rock outcropping in the bluffs that's sparsely vegetated with stands of grasses and wildflowers. That's probably Pier Shale. The sparse nature of the vegetation may beat its slope, but there may also be another reason. An interesting aspect of Pier Shale is that it's generally high in sulfates. So when it rains, the water reacts with the sulfates to produce sulfuric acid. It's a dilute solution, to be sure, but the pH can drop enough in places to hinder plant establishment and growth. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Botineau and writes a weekly column for the Lake Metegoshi Mirror. Still to come, uppity women make history. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Bismarck lawmaker wants the legislature to study whether the Life Skills and Transition Center in Grafton should be closed and replaced with community-based services. That center serves people with disabilities. In the 1980s, when it was called the Grafton State School, it was one of the focal points for a lawsuit brought by the Association for Retarded Citizens. That lawsuit led to the closing of the San Haven State Hospital. Republican State Senator Nicole Poolman introduced the study resolution.
The reason behind the study is to take a look at how can we make sure that we have community-based services for people all across the state so that people can stay closer to family, maybe even stay with family. Maybe they want to live independently. Maybe they need to be in a group home. There are all sorts of options out there, but we want to make sure that those options are available across the state and not just in one location.
Poolman says the center is not as efficient as it used to be.
We only have about 49 residents there, and we have 327 employees, something in that neck of the woods. And so when we have so many employees and so few residents, one has to ask the question, are we at a point where we could be spending that money more efficiently across the state and keeping people closer to their families and within their communities?
Poolman says the U.S. Supreme Court's Olmstead decision says states should put people with mental disabilities in community settings, not in institutions. Closing the center would likely mean amending the state constitution to take the institution out. And North Dakota's economy strengthened sharply in February. The state's business conditions index rose from just below 50 at 49.7 in January to 66.8 in February. Any reading above 50 indicates economic growth. Dr. Ernie Goss is an economics professor at Creighton University. He conducts the economic survey for the Midwest region, which includes North Dakota. He says health services and oil exploration have helped boost the state's economy.
It has a lot to do with oil prices moving above $50 a barrel. And, of course, the more that moves up, that's going to be good. And even in North Dakota, and for that matter, the rest of the region, the rural areas not doing as well as the urban areas. Now, in North Dakota, some of the rural areas are doing better with the oil prices, again, moving above 50 and approaching $55 a barrel. And if they should go to $60 a barrel, of course, that would be good for North Dakota and Oklahoma, two of the states in our Mid-American survey.
Goss says he thinks the numbers will move higher, but they may be getting ahead of themselves. He says projections could be slightly skewed toward positive results, and any disruption could jeopardize that. Goss says disturbance in trade relations could change the game.
President Trump does talk a lot about trade, and he's usually on the side opposite of economists. We think trade is free trade and fair trade is good for the economy, and he seems to have some doubts about that. I hope his bark is worse than his bite. Commodities are hit very quickly there, and of course North Dakota depends heavily on commodities, that whether it's energy or farm agricultural commodities, and that's where you get hit first.
Goss says according to current projections, North Dakota is looking at positive job growth over the next 6 months. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are launching a month-long series on quote-unquote uppity women. The word uppity, it can mean snobby, but in this case, it means self-assertive, especially when that is seen as an act of rebellion. It is March, and that means it's Women's History Month. In our first installment of the series, we learn about a slave woman whose culture landed her accusations of witchcraft.
Welcome to the Fair Sex Calendar, where today in history, women make the news. This is in celebration of Women's History Month for the 31 days of March. True stories of women who chose to rock boats as well as cradles. Many are names you haven't heard of until author Vicki Leone brings their deeds to vivid life.
March 1st, 1692. Today, in Salem Village, Massachusetts, 4 days of witchcraft hearings begin for a Caribbean black woman named Tituba, the household slave of the Paris family. She's accused of sorcery when her tall tales from the West Indies mesmerize the family's daughters and their little friends. Accused by these hysterical children, then beaten by her master, at length, Tituba confesses the diabolical details the Puritan authorities seem to crave. After being interrogated, she's thrown in prison. While incarcerated, 20 executions for witchcraft take place, most of them women. Tituba fears the worst. But after 17 months, she's freed, only to face a huge bill for jailhouse food and lodging. Since she cannot pay, Tituba is sold down the river again.
These and other true tales of outrageous women who refuse to button up or back down are drawn from the books by historical detective Vicki Leone. The newest of her 9 nonfiction titles on women's history is 4,000 Years of Uppity Women. Visit VickiLeone.com for more on her books, including ebook editions. Our theme music is by Cafe Musique. That Schoenberg Rag by Larry Unger.
Tomorrow, a look at the life of Elizabeth Avile MacArthur, the woman who created Australia's first wool export venture while tending a dairy farm and 7 children, all while her husband spent most of his time in England. But now we are going to talk with Bill Thomas. Bill, I bet you've known some uppity women in your life.
Oh, they're the best kind. Yes, yeah. Definitely the most stimulating. And that series, the Uppity Women series, has been going for a few years and come up with a lot of great stories.
There are so many stories that have been ignored in the past, and so it's fun to bring that to light with the series. Bill, you are joining me, director of radio, to talk about Poetry Out Loud. You have been a judge at this high school competition for a number of years, right around 10 years. Mm-hmm. You judge this annual competition. You have been the producer of many radio pieces on poetry and poets. Of course, you have much experience in the world of communications, and you have a long-standing interest in poetry, all of which qualify you to be a judge. If anyone is not familiar with Poetry Out Loud, give us just the elevator speech.
It's a high school contest sponsored by the National Poetry Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. In a school, if they choose to participate, they have a school-wide contest. There is a winner from that school. The winner advances to the statewide contest. They compete. It's, you know, competitive poetry reading. And the winner of the North Dakota statewide contest goes to the nationals that take place April 26th in Washington, D.C.
And this year there were 17 performers, 17 students representing mm-hmm. 17 schools. Just briefly, what kinds of poems, what poets do you tend to hear frequently, or is there a pretty good mix?
Well, it's a mix. They can't choose just any poem, you know, by any random author or anything like that. To have narrow the field a little bit, the Poetry Foundation has an anthology that they, you know, they change around once in a while of 400 poems that the students can choose from. So they got to be recognized poets. Some of them are old, some of them are new, and the students are encouraged to choose one of their poems from before 1900.
Okay. And so teachers at the school coach the students along, and then the students get to perform, is it 2 poems at
well,
the competition?
Well, there's 2 rounds, and then after that, there's finalists chosen, and then the finalists do, there's 5 finalists, and they do 1 final round.
Okay.
And, yeah, you know, it's interesting because there are certain poems that do recur year after year because they're just good reading poems, you know, and certain authors, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, contemporary authors, Jane Oliver is a common one, Naomi Shihab Nye. There's a wider spread, I guess, among the contemporary authors. William Carlos Williams comes up a lot, who's sort of between the 19th century and the 21st century. A wide range of poems. It's fun.
And you have recorded the winners, or some of the finalists and the winner. Want to set up the first one we'll listen
to? Sure. Okay, so we're going to hear, you'll get to judge yourself. These are the 5 finalists, so you can choose which one you would have chosen as the winner. The first one we're going to hear is Ellie Noah. She's from Shanley High School. Brian Jeffrey is her coach there. And Ellie's a great reader. And this poem, it's a contemporary poem. I think the meaning is clear. It's kind of poignant in a way.
Quite Frankly by Mark Halliday. They got old, They got old and died. But first, okay, but first, they composed plangent depictions of how much they lost and how much cared about losing. Meantime, their hair got thin and more thin as their shoulders went slumpy. Okay, but not before the photo albums got arranged by them. Arranged with a niftiness. Not just two or three, but 18 photo albums. Yes, 18 eventually. 18 albums proving the beauty of them and not someone else. Them and their relations and friends. Incontrovertible. Playing croquet in that Bloomington yard. Floating on those comic inflatables at Dow Lake. Giggling at the Dairy Queen. Waltzing at the wedding. Building a Lego palace on the porch. Holding the baby beside the rental truck. Leaning on the Hemingway statue at Pamplona. Discussing the eternity of art in that Sardinian restaurant. Yes, and so, quite frankly, at the end of the day, they got old and died, okay, sure, but quite frankly, how much does that matter in view of the 18 photo albums? Big ones, 13 inches by 12 inches each, full of such undeniable beauty.
18 years, 18 albums worth of life experience in that poem. Bill, what's the next poem?
Okay, the next one is another female poet, Maddie Mock, or female reader. And the last one, I think, you know, is very straightforward in its meaning. It could have been a conversation in a way, though, put together poetically. This one is a little more abstruse, but I think the meaning is very, very clear. Maddie is from Mandan High School, and Candace Brannon was her coach.
Becoming a Redwood by Dana Goya. Stand in a field long enough and the sounds start up again. The crickets, the invisible toad who claims that change is possible, and all the other life too small to name. First one, then another, until innumerable. They merge into the single voice of a summer hill. Yes, it's hard to stand still, hour after hour, fixed as a fence post, hearing the steers snort in the dark pasture, smelling the manure, and paralyzed by the mystery of how a stone can bear to be a stone. The pain the grass endures, breaking through the earth's crust. Unimaginable, the redwoods on the far hill, rooted for centuries. The living wood grown tall and thickened with 100,000 days of light. The old windmill creaks in perfect time to the wind shaking the miles of pasture grass, and the last farmhouse light goes off. Something moves nearby. Coyotes hunt these hills in packs of feral dogs. But standing here at night accepts all that. You are your own pale shadow in the quarter moon, moving more slowly than the crippled stars, part of the moonlight as the moonlight falls. Part of the grass that answers the wind. Part of the midnight's watchfulness that knows there is no silence but when danger comes.
There's no silence but when danger comes.
Yeah, that was really well presented.
Becoming a Redwood. Yeah, she had a very low-key presentation. Mm-hmm. They don't go at Poetry Out Loud. They don't go for lots of big acting drama kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the meaning comes through so much more clearly to me hearing somebody read it than just like reading it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Now, next one, this is another one where it's called Death of Allegory. It's a Billy Collins poem. He's a very popular poet these days. It's about a change in artistic fashion, but it's also kind of about a change in the world and how we feel in the world. And this is read by Zach Howitt. He's from Northern Cass, and his coach is Don Hollister.
The Death of Allegory by Billy Collins. I am wondering, what became of all those tall abstractions that used to pose, robed and statuesque in paintings, and parade about on the pages of the Renaissance, displaying their capital letters like license plates? Truth, cantering on a powerful horse. Chastity, eyes downcast, fluttering with veils. Each one was marble come to life, a thought in a coat. Courtesy, bowing with one hand always extended. Villainy, sharpening an instrument behind a wall. Reason with her crown and constancy alert behind a helm. They are all retired now, consigned to a Florida for tropes. Justice is there, standing by an open refrigerator. Valor lies in bed, listening to the rain. Even Death has nothing to do but mend his cloak and hood, and all their props are locked away in a warehouse. Hourglasses, globes, blindfolds, and shackles. Even if you called them back, there are no places left for them to go. No garden of mirth or bower of bliss. The valley of forgiveness is lined in condominiums, and chainsaws are howling in the forest of despair. Here, on the table near the window, is a vase of peonies, and next to it, black binoculars and a money clip. Exactly the kind of thing we now prefer. Objects that sit quietly on a line in lowercase. Themselves and nothing more. A wheelbarrow. An empty mailbox. A razor blade resting in a glass ashtray. As for the others, the great ideas on horseback, and the long-haired virtues in embroidered gowns, it looks as though they have traveled down that road you see on the final page of storybooks, the one that winds up a green hillside and disappears into an unseen valley where everyone must be fast asleep.
Zach Howitt. And next we're going to hear Josie Wutsky from Legacy High School. Mandy Wardner was her coach. This is a poem from the 1870s, and but the feeling is extremely relatable.
When I heard The Learned Astronomer by Walt Whitman. When I heard The Learned Astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them. When I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became tired and sick. Till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars.
I might never be able to look at the stars the same way again.
Yeah, Josie did a good job on that. Now, the next one, this is a poem that was new to me, and it's, it starts out very matter-of-factly, told from the point of view of a nurse. Two students actually chose this poem this year. It's always interesting to hear different readings. They were both good. This is Emily Gilsrud, and Emily is from Wahpeton, and Christy Maurer is her coach.
Dear Reader, by Rita Mae Reese. You have forgotten it all. You have forgotten your name, where you lived, who you loved, why. I am simply a nurse. Terse and unlovely, I point to things and remind you what they are. Chair. Book. daughter. Soup. And when we are alone, I tell you what lies in each direction. This way is death, and this way, after a longer walk, is death. And that way is death, but she won't see it until it is right in front of you. Once, after your niece had been to visit you, and I said something about how you must love her, or she must love you, or something useless like that. You gripped my forearm in your terrible, swift hand and said, "She is everything." You gave me a shake, everything to me. And then you fell back into the well. Deep in the well of everything, and I stand at the edge and call, "Chair. Book. Daughter. Soup."
Boy, you really had your work cut out for you, didn't you, Bill?
So those were the five finalists. That was Emily Gilsrud from Wapaton. And yeah, we had to pick, you know, who were going to be the final winners. And it was hard. Boy, that last poem, that's a killer poem, too.
It is, yeah. I think just me and not getting to hear the other poems performed, I might go with that last one.
Well, it was really good. It's hard to choose. I'll tell you who the winner was, though. The overall winner, who's going to the Nationals, representing North Dakota in the Listener Auditorium of George Washington University in Washington, D.C., will be Zach Howitt from Northern Cass.
Okay. Okay, so he gets an all-expenses trip paid to the National Competition of Poetry Out Loud, and he also wins money for his school to buy poetry books.
Right,
so that's really fun.
Yeah, and he gets a couple hundred bucks.
Would you ever want to judge at Nationals?
Oh, well, it would be really cool. They do webcast live, so you can watch them live on the internet. And, yeah, that would be really fun, but, boy, would it be difficult.
Oh,
it would be so hard. I mean, you really study a lot to judge this, all the different elements that you look at, their articulation and recitation and physical presence and dramatic presentation and evidence of understanding of the poem. And they're all pretty good. I mean, these were the five top ones, but they were all pretty good.
All right. Bill Thomas, director of radio, just back from judging the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition. Bill, thanks as always.
Sure.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2017 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So break out the magic markers and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who submits a story will receive a certificate of achievement. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. The deadline to submit your original story is March 24th.
This is Dakota Date Book for March 1st. Today we share another story about Professor E.F. Ladd, the well-known champion of purity in consumer products. In 1890, President Stockbridge of the newly founded North Dakota Agricultural College invited Professor Ladd to become professor of chemistry at the college and chemist of the Agricultural Experiment Station. Ladd agreed and joined the first group of instructors at the new institution. Ladd's interests ran from medication and canned foods to paint. In 1902, he was appointed state food commissioner, a post he held until 1921. Through his research, he concluded that North Dakota had become a dumping ground for impure foods. Thanks to him, North Dakota passed the Adulteration of Food Act in 1903. This was 3 years before the United States Congress passed a pure food law. Citizens of North Dakota came to respect and appreciate Ladd's concern for the consumer. His associates described him as unimaginative and a very stern teacher, obsessed with analytical approach. But he was also described as devoted to very high standards and has been called a hero of the pure food and drug movement. On this date in 1912, Professor Ladd issued a warning to farmers. According to the Devil's Lake Interocean newspaper, Ladd addressed concerns he'd received regarding the Farmers General Service Company. Consumers wanted to know if the company was in compliance with the laws of North Dakota. Ladd said the company could be a valuable resource for farmers, but only if it intended to give the farmer full value for the money expended. In the course of Ladd's investigation, he talked to companies that did business with Farmers General. He said one company would accept transactions with Farmers General on a cash-only basis. Others said they had done no business with Farmers General, but were being featured in the company's advertisements. Ladd came to the conclusion that Farmers General did not comply with the laws of North Dakota, saying it is questionable if the service is of benefit to the consumer. The company had not registered food and medicinal products as required by state law. He warned that employees of the company were responsible for the violation. Ladd was right. As it turns out, Farmers General Service Company was putting it over on farmers in several states, taking money up front for the promise of lower prices on supplies and higher prices for the farmers' production, but having no means of fulfilling either promise. This Ponzi-like scheme often preyed upon new immigrants and eventually led to federal charges for fraud. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, says there are two sides to President Trump.
Donald Trump, when he gives his speeches, talks like a populist, and he talks to middle class and working America and poorer people. But when he governs, at least in his first 40 days, he governs like a hard right guy.
But he is the man in the White House. I'm Steve Inskeep. How Democrats hope to work their way back toward power on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Well, that is it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about the Colgate meteorite. This is the biggest ever meteorite found in North Dakota, and it weighs in at a whopping 84 pounds. UND Assistant Professor Nels Foreman originally identified the rock as a meteorite back in 1999, and now he is taking a look inside, and he joins us to discuss meteorites in North Dakota. He has written a book about the subject. Also, it's Thursday. We're going to visit with Chef Rosie with his food topic, and Doug Hamilton and I will share our What's Happening calendar of events for fun and other kinds of entertainment across the weekend. That's all coming up tomorrow on the show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your evening.